Hey guys! So, instead of my normal intro today, I wanted to let you know how you can help the people who are currently being affected by the wildfires on the West Coast. These fires were caused by many environmental factors, including, but not limited to, pyrotechnics at a fucking gender reveal. So, check out GoFundMe for an official fundraiser for the victims in general, as well as the Bay Area Foodie Wildfire Fund, Northern California Wildfire Animal Rescue Fund, and California Wildfire Relief Fund. Specific locales are taking donations too, like the Puentes Emergency Fire Relief Fund, which assists rural communities like Pescadero, Loma Mar, and Año Nuevo. The Solano Disaster Relief Fund, the North Valley Community Foundation, and Community Foundation Santa Cruz are taking donations as well. You can also donate to Global Giving, Health America, and VimaNet. A quick and easy way to donate right this moment is to text Red Cross to 90999, which automatically makes a $10 donation, or fill out their online form and write in California Wildfires for the money to go straight to relief efforts. You can even add the Ecosia extension on Chrome. It uses any and all profits made from your online search to plant trees where they are needed most, reducing carbon dioxide. So, thank you. I hope you enjoy my interview with Sam as much as I did, and let's start the show. Hello, Sam.
Hi, it's nice to meet you, even though it's virtually. This is kind of cool.
I know your setup is a lot more professional than mine. You have like these nice lights in the background. You have a whole brick wall. I have clothes. yeah, and you have your books in the background too. I don't have books yet, but one of these days, right?
There you go. I have a publishing company, just saying. That's something that I do, I guess.
So. are you having a good Labor Day?
It's good. It's really good. I'm just doing what we normally do, and that's this work a bunch and
just excellent. Hang out. Yeah. that's you know what though? It keeps you going, right? If you don't have something to do, then like what, you know. So welcome out in the woods. This is actually, you're my first guest that I don't really know personally.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So this is going to be new territory, but, I think we're going to have a whole lot of fun. So yeah, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, you know, maybe talk about like your background, where you're from, where are you now?
Sounds good. Well, I'm Sam Goodman. I'll start with more of the professional side of things, I guess, to begin with. But I'm a creator and an author, safety consultant. I'm in human and organizational performance. So that's a really, really kind of wacky way of saying that I help organizations treat people more like people.
Yes.
A little bit culturally nicer is one way to put that.
Right.
But I write a bunch of books. I've written books around the safety profession. Mm-hmm. I've recently just written a book called Obscured, which is around my experience coming out and growing up in rural Appalachia and growing up in a very religious family. So I just finished that up over the past couple of weeks. Mm. As I kind of mentioned, I founded a publishing company called Pale Horse Media Co. And that's what we do. We kind of create cool stuff and curate cool books and just call kind of all things indie publishing. And then I do podcasting too. So I have a podcast called the Hop Nerd Podcast. And then I also co-host one, which I don't know how PG you keep things. But it's called Really Effing Scary. Okay. So I can say it's Really Fucking Scary Stories.
Yes.
And so you can find those anywhere. So that's paranormal, true crime, kind of all that kind of wacky stuff. We've been diving into, kind of the Appalachian folklore more recently, which has been a lot of fun, and kind of mountain witches and all of that kind of cool stuff.
Scary shit.
And then the hop nerd is kind of, exactly. That's why it's way more fun than anything else I do. but the hop nerd is more into like the professional side of things and organizational culture and how all that stuff works. But to kind of tell you a little bit about where I'm originally from, I grew up in a small town called Richlands, Virginia, which is kind of nestled in between Blacksburg, Virginia, and Bristol, Virginia, Tennessee, if you're kind of familiar with where Virginia Tech is or any of that kind of stuff.
I'm not, but so, I mean...
yeah, it's when, well, the problem that I have when I tell people that I'm from Virginia is they're very quick. Oh, so you're from around like DC or you're from around Norfolk or Newport News. And I'm like, no, you have to think the entire opposite end of the state, like go way into the mountains. The difference is like, so there's a line, like an invisible line in the state of Virginia, right? That kind of separates Virginia north and south, right? And above that line, you can't tell a good biscuit from a bad one. And below that line, you can tell a good biscuit from a bad one. So that's the way we really determine.
Perfect way to describe it. For our international listeners, we're talking about like actual like Southern biscuits, like fluffy bread, not cookies. Okay. So yeah, not all.
So we're talking the difference between rolled and cut or cathead biscuits.
A good old cathead biscuit. Don't ask us to explain the origin of the name cathead, but because nobody really knows. But yeah.
But yeah, so and then I found myself over the past couple of years. So I started traveling for work, and that took me all over the Carolinas and the Southeast. I'd spent several years in North and South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I'd spent about a year around Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Yeah.
I'd spent some time here and there and everywhere. And then finally, the job that I was doing, I basically traveled around working in power plants, kind of power plants here and there and everywhere. Doing these kind of short-term outage things. It was great. You know, it's great when you're a young person and you can just kind of travel and then go home in the summer and do nothing for a couple months and travel some more. You know, it's pretty awesome. But then the company I was working for was like, hey, we have a temporary assignment in Arizona, which if you would like to go. So I found myself coming to Arizona, and that temporary assignment was, you know, 10 or 12 years ago. And I've been here for that long, which eventually turned into something else. And a couple employers later, I'm in Phoenix, Arizona.
What's that desert climate like compared to the subtropical climate we have around here?
So it's hot. I will say that it's hot. There is something to say about the whole like dry heat thing. That is kind of true.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see it through here, but I'm like I have a towel down here because in the little studio that we're in, air conditioner can't keep up because it's like 117 degrees outside right now.
Oh Jesus.
So it's not humid, but it's super duper hot. And really the only way that I can describe people that haven't lived here, at least for an extended period of time, is that Arizona just doesn't have seasons. There's just two. It's just, it's hell and then it's beautiful. And that's it. there's, you know, 80% of the year, it's just sunshine, no rain, beautiful, 70 degrees. Mm-hmm. And then summertime is just awful. It's just awful.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, not only that, but I know, of course, the cultures are different out there too, but we will get into that
for sure
later. So big question, you know, when did you know you were different? And I'm just going to put something out there. You know, of course, you're very straight passing, audience, you can't see him, but I'm looking at him and he's very straight passing. He looks like just a dude you'd see having a beer at the bar. Like,
Right. to answer the first part of that would probably be right around the time when I would say like 10, 12, kind of that normal age of when you just start to notice in general, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was. Let me say that. I was like, okay, something's odd here, you know?
Yeah.
something's awry. I don't know what this is.
To say the least.
right. And, but yeah, I mean, at the time I was just kind of going, oh, okay, so this is, you know, I'm noticing things that I didn't quite notice before. And now I don't know quite what to do with that. So that was probably in that, if I had to put an age on it, it would be somewhere between 10, 11, 12, 13, kind of in that normal,
right?
I would say probably the puberty age range would probably be.
Yeah.
And to kind of touch on some of the second half of that, and that's something that was pretty interesting as I kind of found out and discovered myself and kind of grew through this journey. That almost made it harder, it seemed. Mm-hmm. As you said, you know, it's not as... I guess no one would have assumed, you know what I mean? I guess that would be the right way to say that.
Yeah.
Which isn't, just it made it a very interesting coming out, to say the least.
It makes it a dangerous game, because I feel like people who would might be attracted to you might be afraid to approach you, especially in the setting of Appalachia. Yeah. You know,
absolutely.
So you might have missed some opportunities there.
Tons, oh for sure, but, tons. So that happened like later. That was like later on, like well long and gone. It's like, oh really? Like after the fact, you know?
Right.
2,000 miles away now. Thanks. Yeah. Gee, thanks.
Right. but you are happily married now. And you do have a child.
Almost close.
Oh,
yeah, we're not quite. So yeah, he's sitting on the other side of this television working on stuff. So he knows what I'm going to say. He's supposed to be asking at some point, and he never has. So we'll see where this goes.
Hey, you know, anticipation is sometimes greater than the reward, right?
It is. It really is. Yeah.
So what is it like in Appalachia for a queer person, or what was your experience?
Mine was never really that great. I mean, I could just throw that out there to begin with. I would just say that my experiences led me to really cover up hard and like deeply suppress who I was for a very, very, very long time. I didn't really come out until I was in Arizona. Like I didn't really come out until I was in a position to where it was really, and this is the way that I describe it to people. Most of us come out when we're in a position where it's safe for us, or we feel that it's safe for us to do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel safe. And I don't mean that necessarily from physical danger. Mm-hmm. But I grew up in a very religious household. And if I would have walked in and just been, hey, y'all, I'm gay, I would have been kicked out of the house and like living on the street somewhere. I would have been right. That kid. Right. Because it would have been, if I can't pray the gay out of you, you're not going to live under my roof.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the experience wasn't that great. It's interesting because the mountains were originally a place where kind of bandits and outlaws and everyone that was different went to live.
Uh-huh.
For the fact that they're not very accepting of others anymore, they kind of grew into that role. But it was very interesting because even from obviously the town is kind of in the middle of the Bible Belt, you know, mm-hmm. everyone is pretty extremist when it comes to religion in that area. A good portion of folks, mm-hmm. My family included. And then just kind of the small town mentality as well.
Yes.
Where it was kind of this, I don't know. I was kind of indoctrinated from an early age to see anything that's different is bad. Mm-hmm. And the last thing that you want to be in a small town setting, especially, is placed in that other category.
Right.
Because other means outcast, and outcast means that you're just excluded from everything. So the experience overall, not that great.
So I assume that, and I feel like, I mean, this is relatable to me too, because that kind of environment makes you, I mean, it gives you a little internalized homophobia for a little bit whenever you first realize, yeah. you know, your own identity. And it also, I mean, for me, I mean, it just makes me feel so guilty because at the time, you know, I was so indoctrinated by that whole idea, that whole religion, that I was, you know, I was not cruel, but I had homophobic tendencies, even though deep sure. down inside I was, and I was just running from it, you know?
Same.
You
know, it was really interesting because I I grew up, I went to, for the first 5 years of my life, or first 5 years of school, I guess.
Yeah.
I went to a Christian academy, then into public school. Mm. You know, and I grew up in a, most folks out here don't really know what I'm talking about. I'm sure that you will, but I grew up in a Southern Pentecostal church.
Oh, Jesus.
So very, yeah, exactly.
Yes.
That's the key word.
Yeah.
Capital J. And so, and the weird part was, is that I found a lot, there was a lot of amazing people in that church. And I think that's probably the saddest part about it is there's a lot of folks in that church that I consider family, folks I still talk to.
Yeah.
That basically once I came out, they just kind of disown you though. They're like, well, I love you, but I don't like your choices.
Yeah.
The
love the sinner, hate the sin. Yeah.
Right. But I found myself in the same position because I grew up sitting under sermons of kind of hellfire, brimstone, like just a couple degrees off from Westboro Baptist Church style kind of rants.
Yeah.
You know, it just like if the preacher had a bad day, we could probably devolve into some Westboro Baptist Church style stuff.
Oh my God.
It's so it kind of leaves you with that same feeling. And that's what when people ask me that, you know, what's the first thing that you really felt, you know, when you truly realized, and it was shame. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's not what people should feel when they realize that, but that's
right.
what I was taught to feel was shame, kind of shame, yes. Guilt. And that ultimately led to some pretty obvious, you know, internalization of some stuff and then depression and kind of all the stuff that kind of comes along with that.
And that's another thing, you know, the South itself is kind of, is a very rural place, but, rural, yeah. But, Appalachia is very isolated, in the United States. I mean, it's coal country. It's up in the mountains. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, there are some parts that are hard to access even today.
Yes.
So, you know, you kind of have a petri dish and a breeding ground for any kind of ideas that the loudest person wants to push on people, you know?
Right. And it's so interesting because, they're such loving and caring people. And I want to throw that out here right now.
Yeah.
That, and that's my general experience with Appalachia, with the South, with a lot of love, a lot of awesome people.
Mm-hmm.
I found a lot of acceptance. Don't get me wrong. I did at some point. But the general kind of tone is not very great. around different, not good.
Know your audience is
exactly. But so a lot of amazing people, a lot of great people, kind of the salt of the earth people, you know, mm-hmm. that would just give you the shirt off their back, kind of unless you're gay.
Right, exactly.
right, in a lot of ways. And to your point, it is very isolated. And I think that lends to some of those problems,
mm-hmm.
Because you really find that I still know people that live there that have never left there for any reason. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, like 100-mile radius, maybe like they hang out and then the farthest that they've ever gone, which don't get me wrong, I'm a super fan, but they'll go to Dollywood for a weekend.
Yeah.
And then they come back and then that's it. Like they've done that once or twice and then that's life. And they don't travel. They don't experience anyone else. They're not exposed to other cultures. They're not exposed to other people.
Right.
So they're kind of in a vacuum going, well, everything's supposed to be like this. And if it's not like this, then it's probably bad. And superstition and all the other stuff kind of kicks in, and kind of religious superstition, you know,
right.
And it just kind of spirals out of control into nothing really great.
So how has that kind of environment shaped who you are today? Now, you know, we talked about the internalized homophobia initially, but today, what would you say you still carry from that experience, that growing up that you went through?
You know, I still have to catch myself. Like, I still catch myself, my instant, when I meet new people, especially, the kind of shields automatically go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as anyone that I meet, anyone that I meet that's new, I instantly find myself trying to cover, like before I even need to. Like, does that make sense? I kind of find myself in this weird place where I'm like, no, wait, I'm not gay. No,
right.
I have a soon to be husband. Like, it's not, you know, but I still carry that kind of instinct with me of it's this fight or flight self-protection kind of mechanism that's still there that I haven't been able to get rid of. I've worked through a lot of kind of the baggage that comes with that. And I think any of us that come from that environment, if you say that you don't have baggage from that, you're lying to yourself. You definitely carry
seriously. Do some meditation, honey. Do some meditation.
Absolutely. It's okay. Talk to people, do some meditation. There's a lot of great resources out there.
Right. You know,
there really are. But so I had to work through a lot of that stuff. But that's the one that I still kind of hang on to. You know, there's great stuff that comes from that upbringing as well. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Like I'm that sad fool that will stand there and hold the door open for like everybody to like go through.
God.
In Arizona, they look at me like I'm stupid. I'm like the person that's like, come on, I've got the door. Come on.
I was about to say, as a kid, you know, that was the big thing that all the churchmen would say when they got back from a mission trip to like New York or somewhere. Those women just looked at me like I had three heads because I held the door up more. You ever heard of such? But like, yeah.
You know, the one that I get picked on more for the, you know, more here in Arizona than anything else is the Mr. and Mrs. So
yeah,
even folks that I'm like, You know, if I have a friend that's Joe Bob, you know, hey, Mr. Joe, what's going on? You know, like, why are you calling me Mr. Joe? I don't know. That's just what what I do. Or yeah. Some strange words, like they pick up me for saying buggy instead of shopping
yeah,
cart.
Yeah, buggy. Buggy.
They're like,
yeah.
What the hell's a buggy?
Fucking, I had a teacher from Chicago, and she got so mad whenever we would call her ma'am. She made sure to, she was like, don't call me ma'am. That where I'm from, I know that's a respect thing here, but honestly, it makes you look kind of simple. And it's like, oh, okay, well, thanks. Yeah. So
oh,
it's so weird. It's so weird. We're the South. Just the South is just a huge mixed bag. It really is. You know, it really is.
Well, it's interesting because in kind of the Appalachian Mountains, it's the same because you get it's Appalachian, but it's inherently Southern too, right?
I mean, yes,
everything is kind of at the base Southern, like even down to like the food, it kind of mm-hmm. has its own kind of style, its own kind of vibe, but everything's kind of predicated on this Southernness that just permeates all
right,
of
right.
Which is really interesting. But yeah, so because, you know, you do have such a mixed bag because so many different folks found their ways into the mountains for various reasons.
Yes.
I'm definitely not an Appalachian historian, so just go look it up on your own. but I mean, bandits and outlaws and everything in between, you know, and everybody else that, you know, basically that really were not wanted anywhere else found themselves living
right
in the mountains.
I mean,
so
again,
to kind of get to the point of being different bad seems kind of odd as a weird evolutionary path for it.
It does, because I literally last week I just got done watching The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia. And they're hill folk, and that's not what I think of all hill folk, but I see them and I'm like, but like, that's, you know, like, that's still like, you know what I mean? That's, they're a symptom of some word of their environment, I guess, or history.
I will gladly say this, you know, I don't have a Bible in here or anything, but I will gladly lay my hand on a Bible and say that, you know, that, and if you haven't watched the original, so there's ones before that called The Dancing Outlaw. So they're really hard to find, but you can find them on YouTube. So there's if anybody's looking for something really hilarious to watch, you should go watch that. But I will tell you that is a cross slice of Appalachia. That those folks, like, that is true. Like, that's real. That's very real. All of us have cousins like the Wild and Wonderful Whites. I'm not that's not an exaggeration. Like, I've got like four or five folks that are coming to mind right now that you could like interchange with the cast of that movie very easily.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, and you know, it's there's a really deep underlying issue of addiction and kind of other stuff there.
Yes.
That's fueled by depression and that feeling of being stuck there, and then just the economy. There's a lot of deeper things there, but
it's just like everything else. It's not as simple as just being like, well, they're just trash. No. You know, like, no,
right,
like,
right, yeah. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of those folks is wild and wacky and wonderful, I guess, as they are. As they are. A lot of them are just kind of surviving in the circumstances that they're in.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they found their way into addiction or other things. And it's just, yeah, it's ended up wild and wonderful.
So speaking of stuff that's wild and wonderful, how would you compare the LGBT communities where you're from to the LGBT communities to where you are now?
So the biggest difference would be that there is a community. So that's probably the first place that I would start. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to kind of where I grew up, it's funny, like if you go back now and if you open up like Grindr or something, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're going to see like all of these married dudes, right? That's the community. So I say that because that's the community there, other than like, you know, a small handful of kind of out folks.
Right.
And so that would be the biggest difference, kind of coming to, especially in Phoenix. So I'm in Phoenix, and Phoenix is just this wonderful kind of mixed bag of everything diverse and everything kind of different and new and everything, right? You just kind of have a good cross slice of everything. That's one really interesting thing about Phoenix just in general, is that not many folks that live in Phoenix are from Phoenix. Like, it seems rare to meet someone that's from Phoenix. Everyone seems to be a transplant, or at least a good portion of us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would probably be the first step, though, or the first thing to say, is that there is a community. I find that you know, folks are wildly more accepting, but then again, you still run into a lot of the same mindsets. So I can't pin that just on the South or,
yeah,
you know, the rural towns that I grew up in, you know, again, unfortunately, due to perceptions sometimes around my appearance, folks don't realize that I'm a member of the community, especially in like a professional setting.
Yeah.
So I get to hear very interesting conversations sometimes.
Yeah. Know,
which is not great, just by the way, which is not wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can quickly see that like a story that I share with folks is I was literally, it's not current employer, nothing like that. It's several mm-hmm. years ago. If anybody wants to go like research me, they could probably do the math, but I was literally sitting, and this was here, and this was with folks that, you know, kind of from more metro areas. They're not, you know, from the backwoods in any way, shape, or form.
Right.
I am. And like, I'm literally sitting in this very professional business meeting, and the meeting hadn't started yet. And like this very high level executive from an organization is basically going on this rant about, you know, how God has cursed our country because of the gays. And like, this is in a very professional, like a professional setting in this city, like, you know, where this, like the exact place where this shouldn't be happening, you know, where I would expect this back home. But so I guess, you know, the way that I describe it is that, you know, that kind of homophobia and bigotry has cousins and they live in Phoenix too. They kind of live a little bit everywhere. But overall, Phoenix is a much more open and accepting place. Mm-hmm. Phoenix has this very kind of really thick streak of, I don't care what you do as long as you don't bother me. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of the Phoenix kind of Wild West kind of feel of this area. I'll just say that Phoenix is very politically diverse as well, which is good.
Okay.
I think it's cool. It's very cool because you get folks that are kind of all over the map, which is kind of, I like that. I think it's neat to have just this really kind of just wide swath of varying people, which is kind of cool.
That is, especially right now. I mean, this is not about politics, but yeah, especially right now. I mean, I don't have to say anything, but we all know, like, we need somewhere to bridge the gap, you know, like.
Yeah, everything's horrible. I mean, that's just a really good way to put
that's,
it.
That's, yeah, exactly.
It's all horrible.
Everything is terrible. But on that note, actually, let's go ahead and take a quick break. And when we come back, we can talk a little bit more about your professional life. Hello, everybody. The following is a small list of places you can donate for Black lives and the lives of all people of color all across the United States. National Bailout, The Bail Project, Mutual Aid, The Navajo Water Project, My Block, My Hood, My City, Resist, Black Table Arts, Embrace Race, Social Justice Learning Institute, Black Feminist Project, Integrate NYC, Black Girls Code, Pretty Brown Girl, The Winter Institute, Ramp Your Voice with Velissa, Autistic People of Color Fund, Sins Invalid, ACLU, Black Lives Matter Global Network, Color of Change Education Fund, Anti-Racism Fund, the Refugee Dream Center, Alliance to Mobilize Our Resistance, Black Voters Matter Fund, the Collective Political Action Committee, the National Police Accountability Project, Campaign Zero, Communities United for Police Reform, Equal Justice Initiative, No New Jails NYC, Anti-Recidivism Coalition, Legal Rights Center, Transgender Law Center Black LGBTQIA+ Migrant Project, Up Against the Law Legal Collective, Black Trans Advocacy Coalition, The Okra Project, Brave Space Alliance, Trans Justice Funding Project, The Loveland Foundation, Black Women for Wellness, National Queer and Trans Therapists of Color Network, National Black Disability Coalition, Sister Song, Navajo and OB Families COVID-19 Relief Fund, Orinda Tribe COVID Response, and Dena Hosoto Families COVID-19 Relief Fund. There are many, many more, and they all need our help. So donate, volunteer, and do what you can for the future of people of color in this country. If the system won't, we will, because none of us are free until all of us are free. Hey guys, I can't be energetic for you guys all the time. Okay, look, I'm in a collaboration. Yes, I'm so excited too. It's with a small independent clothing company out of Colorado called That Sounds Gay. They make trendy and comfy fashion with a gay twist, like their top seller, the Sounds Gay I'm In t-shirt. Best of all, and yes, this really is the best of all, a portion of the profits goes to a range of different LGBT plus charities, so you don't have to feel guilty about spending a couple extra bucks on a t-shirt. You're actually helping someone out, okay? So shop today at thtsoundsgay.com, that's thtsoundsgay.com, and get 30% off your entire order when you use promo code ONTW_podcast at checkout. That's ONTW_podcast. Yes. I am a promo code. And we are back. So yeah, we're going to get a little more into your professional side, Sam. So you are a safety professional. Can you explain, because my audience probably does not know what that is. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll keep it really high level, but a lot of what I've dealt with throughout my career is trying to help people not get injured, maimed, or die at work. That's a lot of what I focused on throughout my career.
Important.
And still do.
Yeah.
That's still kind of my main gig. And more so lately, I find myself more into kind of human and organizational performance and organizational culture, and really just a kind of approaching that same problem in a way of just trying to make work better in general, trying to make the world a better place to work.
Mm-hmm.
So a good portion of my career is dealing with exactly that. How to make work safe and how to make it not suck kind of at the same time, and how to make workplaces more culturally sound. And so a lot of what I focus on kind of now in my career is how we grow elements of psychological safety and how we grow the ability for folks to be able to just kind of speak truth, be able to be honest with organizations and ultimately learn. That's really so much of what I focus on in my career, is how to help organizations learn from the folks that actually do the work.
And that's excellent, because that is a big gap in America, in the American workforce, especially when you're a low wage worker.
Yeah.
I think that's why a lot of jobs have such a high turnover rate, because there's really nowhere for people to express their concerns. And even if the boss is like, I'm open, like most of the time, like there's only so far you can go with that.
Well, there's such a systematic issue around, and not to dive too deep down that hole, but there's a huge systematic issue around that, right? That
yes.
We've kind of operated on these management premises that are 100+ years old that say, you know, management smart, workers dumb. And that's clearly
right.
Stupid, right? Let's just say that's clearly stupid. The folks that actually do the work know how work gets done. And that seems to be pretty damn important. Right.
Yeah.
They hold all those magical secrets of how work actually happens. Management doesn't. Right? So management's job is to be able to tune themselves to listen and learn from folks that actually do things. Right?
Exactly.
They don't actually do anything.
Actually, all three of my managers at my job actually listen to this podcast. So guys, you're not dumb. No, you guys are great. But you mentioned human organization and performance, HOP. Earlier. So can you explain a little bit more about what that is for my listeners?
Yeah. So it's really taking, because we mentioned safety kind of right at the beginning, human and organizational performance is kind of another evolution. And it's not just safety. Let me say that human and organizational performance kind of applies across the board. And you'll see why here in just a second. But it's really the next step. So when we think about worker safety, for a very long time, safety was back to that kind of old style management stuff. Mm-hmm. Safety was something that was done to workers, right?
Mm.
It was,
yeah.
You're dumb. I'm going to give you rules to follow. And if you don't follow them, something bad's going to happen to you.
Right.
Run you off. It's not going to be great. You know, I demand perfection. And if you don't give me perfection, if you ever make a mistake, I'm going to beat you with a stick and it's going to be bad. I'm going to shame you, fire you, retrain you, kind of all that kind of normal stuff.
Right, right.
And human and organization performance kind of looks back on that and goes, well, if you want people to tell you about stuff that happens, that's probably not a really good idea, right? Because
yes.
if I tell you that, hey, I made a mistake, and your response is going to be, well, you're an idiot, I'm going to beat you with a stick, you know, I'm probably just not going to tell you anything anymore.
Yeah.
Right? So human and organizational performance really approaches things a little differently. And it starts from this really key difference. It starts to view human error as normal. right? We're humans. Mm-hmm. We make mistakes, right? We've kind of all heard that. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. It's kind of normal. And we just kind of accept that fact that people are going to make mistakes. It's going to happen. And it's our job to make sure that when they do, that it doesn't cost them their life, or it doesn't cost them their arm, it doesn't cost them a finger, or right. anything even more, you know, sometimes more minor. So we start from that point of saying that human error is normal. We accept that fact. We move on. We start to understand that learning is vital, right? That we can either blame or we can learn, right? Yes. We can't really do both. And even down into the reaction piece, we start to understand that how we react matters a lot if we want folks to actually be able to tell us stuff we actually want to learn. So human and organizational performance is kind of this holistic approach to really using the social sciences, mm-hmm. right, to better understand how humans behave within complex systems. Would probably be the summarized version of that.
Yeah.
Right? But to me, it's this. It's getting back to this one very simple statement. If I wanted to sum up human performance or human and organizational performance in one kind of statement, it would be this, that we've started to understand that people are not the problem to control. They're the solution to our problems.
Yes.
That's human and organizational performance in a nutshell.
Excellent. Excellent. So really, that is really fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
Does the emphasis on understanding and forgiveness in the HOP method resonate with you as a queer person? And what aspect of HOP has made you so emphatic about it?
You know, for me, I'll start with the second half of that to begin with. For me, and I literally wrote a book on this because I was ready to walk away from the safety profession. I hate it because of the stuff that we just said, right? I'd gotten to the point where I was burnt out. I was tired. I was being worked into the ground. And we were basically told to go out and fix people. And I just kind of knew that was dumb, right?
Right.
Fix people, right? I was basically go out and cure evolution, right?
Exactly.
I can't cure human behavior, right? I can't cure the fact that people are going to seek efficiency and they're going to do kind of all this normal people stuff, you know? So I got to the point where I was ready to walk away from it until I had a really good friend. I was actually working at a nuclear power plant. I'd been there for several years. And I had a friend kind of knew that I was ready to walk away and had dropped this book off on my desk. And I don't think I have one laying around here, but it was by this gentleman named Sidney Decker. And mm-hmm. he's a professor out of Griffith University. And he'd written a book called Safety Differently. And it kind of describes kind of what we're talking about a little bit. HOP is kind of a little different than Safety Differently, but it's kind of in the same vein.
Uh-huh.
And I started reading this and I'm going, oh, my God, oh, my God. Oh my God, this is exactly what I've been trying to say for years. Finally, somebody wrote all this stuff down. finally, someone with a PhD after the name said, this is real. and it's all true, you know, and I started down that path. But for me, it was that when I got to that point of just being able to say, kind of say, safety kind of has these sacred cows in it where mm-hmm. you have to, as a safety person, you're supposed to say that everything's preventable. And that's just not true.
Right.
Right. Everything's not preventable. Right. And you're supposed to say, well, you know, if we, if you just follow the rules, nothing bad happens. And that's not true. Right. A lot of times.
No.
We all know people that are wearing their seatbelt and doing exactly the speed limit and get T-boned by an 18-wheeler and gets killed.
Right.
Right. That's just not true. You can be doing all the right things and bad things will still happen.
Yes.
Right. So just the fact, what really drew me to it was that to begin with, that we could get beyond a lot of kind of the traditional stupid, mm-hmm. I guess.
Right.
And then what really sunk its teeth into me though, was kind of back to this idea of treating people like people, just being good to people, right?
Right.
Treating people like people is so important. And we've gotten so far away from that. And a lot of companies have, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that if you treat people like people, that seems like a pretty good goal. You know, be nice to people and treat them how you want to be treated. Make the golden rule cool again. You know?
Right, that's right.
That's a pretty good premise. But to kind of the first part of that, I think that, you know, kind of with that in that same vein, understanding that for me, the forgiveness piece and understanding people a whole lot better than what I ever understood them before. So understanding that a lot of folks that might be assholes,
yeah.
You know, folks that might say things that maybe they shouldn't say, that, you know, that might be a product of their environment. You know, that mm-hmm. might be something that maybe they, people can be ignorant, right? They can be ignorant to certain
yes.
things. And, you know, I found that through talking with those people and a lot of times through telling of stories and sharing my story and, you know, I hate to say it like this, but humanizing the LGBTQ plus experience in a lot of ways to those folks, because a lot of them just have never seen it.
No.
Right? They go, oh, okay. Right. they can start to express a little bit of empathy, which is an amazing thing. Right. So for me, a lot of the forgiveness and a lot of those pieces did come from that of understanding that, yeah, people are people and people do stupid things. Right. And, you know, again, I can definitely chalk it up to stupidity the first time around, but I will talk to you. And if you choose to continue, maybe we won't be friends, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. So does your experience as a Southern queer drive your creativity and entrepreneurial spirit? Because you have both, obviously.
Yeah. You know, I think so. So I was always that kid that was like I was always in like art. Like I loved art class. I love drawing. I love music. I've come from a very musical background, a musical family. So I've always been involved in just creative ventures in general. Just all through my upbringing. So I've always kind of loved the creative stuff. And it's kind of odd because most of the time creative folks don't necessarily end up in the profession that I found myself in. Mm-hmm. It's more into like interpretation of laws and regulations and all this stuff. And it's usually not what attracts creative people, you know.
Right.
But for me, it really became kind of the selling point of who I am, right? Or of me as a professional,
right?
Was that I was the person, I'm basically the person then going and teach you how to make creativity cool again in your organization,
right?
And how to teach folks, you know, how to work on culture. And you don't get that through interpretation of regulations or kind of this kind of, you know, suit and tie kind of corporate stuffy, starchy kind of corporate-y stuff. I've always been kind of the opposite of that. So it's really helped me in my profession to kind of be the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. Because that's most frontline employees, you know, back to the folks that do.
Yeah.
It's more relatable because that's kind of normal people. More normal people aren't starchy, stuffy with a tie on, you know, acting like the company's God.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Most folks just want to have a normal conversation with somebody that cares about them. Right. And I think that's a really good starting point. So, for a lot of companies. So yeah, I think that it has helped a ton. And then for me, kind of that, kind of growing up there, music was really an outlet for me. Mm-hmm. Art was really an outlet for me because it just didn't really exist a lot there at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Other than very traditional kind of things.
Like, yeah.
You know, and I'm for that. Don't get me wrong. I can play bluegrass. I can. I promise I can. I really can.
I don't know. You promised, so I don't know.
I played in a bluegrass band for a while, actually, surprisingly. But you know, it for me, kind of growing up and being different, I kind of threw myself in a really extreme direction. I think some of us do.
As soon
as I found myself into like really, really out there, and in a good way, it really helped me kind of shape kind of my my views on art and my views on writing and my views on music and kind of all that stuff kind of in my early formative years, kind of growing up there. And that definitely lends to what I do now, because as I said, I find myself kind of curating all the things that I find to be interesting and cool and kind of beyond just kind of the hop and safety stuff. I find myself, you know, obviously into promotion and books and kind of everything else. It helps a ton.
Excellent. Yeah, you know, just to piggyback off of what you said, you know, I know what you mean about listening to like obscure, you know, experiencing out there stuff, but I think that helps. Once you kind of become familiar with stuff like that, it helps you take stuff that is complex and learn how to box it up into something that is a lot more palatable, I guess. Yeah. And yeah. So yeah, you host a podcast called Really Fucking Scary Stories, which I cannot wait to listen to when I'm not driving home from work at night on these country back roads. Have you ever personally experienced cryptids and or the paranormal?
So not to the point where I could say for sure.
Okay.
Right? So,
okay. Yeah.
So I grew up obviously kind of in the mountains, and the mountains have like a very, very wide streak of superstition, right?
Mm-hmm.
We hear all kinds of stories of, you know, this and that and the other, from hobsows to mountain witches to everything else kind of in between. And don't ask me to describe what a hobsow is. I have no clue.
It sounds like a pig monster.
Everything else, it probably is. I mean, that's what I hope so. But Yeah. So, I mean, other than, you know, being like dumb kids, young way back when, you know, all piling into a car to go ghost hunting, mm-hmm. you know, and finding ourselves in old abandoned buildings, probably full of asbestos and,
right.
and everything else that we shouldn't have been breathing, you know, and scaring ourselves to death. I can't say that I've ever truly experienced anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting though, because we're doing a, it's in a couple of weeks. We're actually going to go on we're taking a haunted road trip, myself and my significant other. And we're actually going to stay in the Copper Queen Hotel.
I'm not familiar.
Notoriously haunted. Yeah. It's one of the more haunted hotels, I guess, in the United States. Mm. We're going to Tombstone, Arizona. We're going to be staying in Tombstone.
Yeah.
We're staying in Bisbee. We're staying in Tucson, and we're taking like a spirit box with us.
Oh, so like a real one?
Like a real one. Yeah.
Oh my
God. We're
going
to go do like the full spirit box thing. Like, so my sister's part of this podcast too. So as my significant other. So she still lives in Virginia. So we're going to do like this interesting Zoom session.
Okay.
This podcast on location at different areas. So I say that because I don't know, maybe after that I can say that I've actually experienced.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, down here, you know, Mississippi, we have some places that are notoriously haunted, supposedly. Mm-hmm. How do I say this? I have experienced the paranormal to a degree, I guess. But, you know, New Orleans is right in our backyard, especially here. Yeah. It's only about 2.5 hours away. And New Orleans, right. Now, that is a completely different animal. I recently, back right before COVID, I was supposed to go to a Mardi Gras parade with a friend of mine. It would be my first Mardi Gras ever. But a couple of nights before was whenever that woman got run over by that parade float. Yeah. So it was windy. Yeah. It got canceled. So they were like, you know what? Let's go to one of the nice restaurants around Slidell. And we went. And my friend went to the bathroom, and you know, you never want anyone messing with you when you're going to the bathroom, but like she said, as she was into, it's down this long dark hallway in this restaurant, and as she was turning the corner to go into the ladies' room, something grabbed the back of her dress and pulled, and she turned around and there was nothing there, and she was like, what the fuck? And so she came back to the table and she was white as a ghost, and I was just like, and she's partially Italian, so she has very olive skin, but she was pale, and I was like, what just happened? And we asked the waiter, you know, she told the waiter what happened, and the waiter was like, well, you know, this place used to be a hospital in the Civil War. It used to be a Civil War hospital for battlefield, and it was like, oh, okay. And yeah,
that's
so
always it. So that, so like, it's a funny story. So like, the one of the first episodes we did for Really Fucking Scary Stories, is we detailed a little town that was next to us called Abington, Virginia, which I grew up right next door to it. I spent a lot of time there. I had family that lived there. There's a lake. There's the lake was there. So when we went to the lake, that's where we would go. And so there was a very old, it used to be like a school, and then it became it was somebody's private residence. So when you look at this thing, it's massive. You're like, how the heck does somebody afford a house that big? But I guess
right.
17, whatever, you can.
Exactly. Slaves. That's what it was.
Exactly. Slaves, that's exactly what it was. So that was part of it. As I started to research it, like, that was part of the basement. Like, they literally kept slaves in the basement.
Oh.
And like, horrible, pissed, of course, angry spirits.
Right.
Supposedly live in the basement. And there's these limestone, because in that part of Virginia, there's all kinds of limestone caves and stuff that connect. So it connected across the street to Virginia's famous Barter Theater.
Oh.
Super cool. So the Barter Theater was formed way back when. The building was there long before, but it was Depression era theater. So you could go watch theater, mm-hmm. and you could barter food instead of money.
For a ticket. Okay.
Which was super cool. And the really cool thing is, so it's still operational. You can go and donate food to like local food banks, and you can go watch instead of paying for a ticket, which is super cool, right? How cool is that?
That is.
But so what happened is, so this massive slave built residence was eventually turned into a school for girls, which again, just creepy story, perfect creepy story, right? And then eventually the Civil War came around. And then it was turned into a field hospital there as well. They used the caves beneath to run ammunition and all kinds of stuff back and forth. And so just awful. And so like, there's numerous ghost stories, all kinds of bad stuff. But so it's always that. It's any like bad hotel story you find. It's like, oh, there's a hospital one time.
Right. Exactly.
There's a hospital one time. But it's funny because as you kind of mentioned, when I was staying in Vicksburg, I spent about a year in Vicksburg. I was working at there's a nuclear power plant in Port Gibson.
Yeah.
So I would drive back and forth between Vicksburg and Port Gibson because there's nowhere to stay in Port Gibson.
Right.
So I was right up against like the battlefield. And people in the hotel would always say that they're like, yeah, if you stare at the battlefield long enough, you will see something. Like, I promise you, you will see something at the Vicksburg battlefield.
Did you ever get out to the McRaven Mansion?
I didn't. No.
Oh, that's also that's a Vicksburg staple. A friend of mine, my best friend actually, my best straight friend. I have to qualify every time, so there's no confusion. But him and his dad went out there probably 10 years ago actually. Wow, time flies. But there was apparently a woman just like walking through and. Apparently, like, there wasn't supposed to be a woman there. And so they were like, okay. So, ghosts and the paranormal and cryptids and aliens and all that, they are scary. But, you know, it's the demons inside that are scarier. So, segue, let's talk about your book. talk about your book, Obscured, the Pursuit of Radical Self-Acceptance, which I definitely want to read now, especially now that I'm talking to you. Definitely seems like an interesting memoir. Let's talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a lot of what we just talked about. It really kind of goes into... it really goes into the bits and pieces in a much more in-depth kind of chat about what we've kind of went into that experience of kind of growing up, not only rural small town, but rural small town religious, you know, and then kind of realizing that you're different. And then kind of this roller coaster ride of, okay, I'm different. No, I'm not. I'm going to hide that. No, I'm different. No, I'm not. Okay. I'm going to hide that.
Right.
And this kind of roller coaster of emotions and suppression and kind of everything else. All the way to the point of, you know, getting into some of like getting into this awful deep depression, this kind of shadow that follows you around from just the inability to truly be yourself and express who you are and to tell your truth, you know, and to be yourself. Where else would that lead other than to horrific, horrible depression?
Right. Right? No, seriously.
I tell people that all the time, that, you know, just imagine excising a massive portion of your life and being told you have to hide that from everyone.
Yes.
It's not your entire life, but it's a significant portion of your life, right?
Right.
To take a sliver out of who you are and say, you can't be that anymore. Hide that from everyone. And because if anyone finds out, it's going to be bad, right? Because I've found myself, you know, and I tell a lot of these stories kind of in the book of just those experiences where you kind of start to build up the courage. And then it was like something would just knock your feet out from under you.
Yeah.
Right. You start to build up that courage. And that's really why I describe it kind of like a roller coaster, is you start to build up that courage. And then you walk into a conversation of somebody saying horrible homophobic something from somebody that you really respect, like a family member or a peer. And you go, okay, I definitely can't say anything yet.
Exactly. No, that's real. Yeah.
Yeah. And the book is really that, and it really talks about those experiences kind of from my perspective. And it really will resonate with folks that have kind of a Southern upbringing or an Appalachian upbringing, or if we're exposed to religion in those ways, but it really resonates with a lot of folks. I've had a lot of my straight friends read it and go, wow, this is really, you know, it's really interesting to see from that perspective, kind of the experiences that folks face, because I don't think people realize that we still have a lot of work to do, I guess, is where I kind of land.
No. And during the break, we were talking about how we had both on separate occasions boosted posts on Facebook, and that just drew in a bunch of homophobes, which, you know, once again, I think, assuming that 2015 was the ultimate victory for gay rights, it's kind of like assuming the Civil Rights Act was the ultimate victory for Black people in America, you know. Right. It's still an ongoing issue. And sometimes, I don't know if you experience this, but even after you come out, sometimes family that you have come out to will still treat you kind of like shit. Like, even after.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So, for sure. I mean,
you know, I think one thing that's really interesting for me, and it's, we still work on it, right? I'm still working on it. I say we, because I still have to be a part of it too.
Yeah.
But just like, I think about like my relationship, I detail my relationship with my mother in particular in my book. She's very Southern Pentecostal lady.
Yes.
And, you know, we went from being very close, talking almost every single day, to nothing. Like, we didn't speak for like 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's just 3 years of my relationship with my mom just gone, that I will never get back.
Yeah.
Because she could not stand the fact. I became dead to her. She would rather have a dead son than a gay one.
Mm.
Basically, right? I'd rather you be dead to me than be gay. I'd just rather just get you out of my life.
Yeah.
That was easier, right? That was easier. So there's 3 years just gone. I don't think folks realize that stuff still happens with frequency.
No, it does. Right?
And back to the point that you know, I'm an old man now. I'm in my early 30s.
Gay ancient.
ancient gay. Yeah. But so it's not been that long ago when you really think about it, that, you know, what, mid early 2000s, 2003, 4, 5-ish, if I would have came out in that time, you know, which would have been during my high school experience.
The Bush administration, which, like, you know.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Exactly. There you go. So I would have been homeless, right? I don't think people realize that that's still pretty normal. You know, that's a normal challenge that folks within our community face.
Yes.
And then, you know, folks on the outside scratch their head and go, I don't know why all these gay kids kill themselves at the rate that they do.
No, I had come out to a cousin before I came out to my parents, and I told them, I was like, just, you know, please don't tell them, you know, like, mm-hmm. I'm just afraid of what might happen. You know, I'm still in college. Like, I still depend on them for this and that. And this piece of shit told me that I was using my parents because I wouldn't tell them because I knew that they would take all of that stuff away. So that is, that's y'all, just so you know, that is the mindset that some people have. Still to this day, that was probably 2014, 2015, and once again, that was only 5 years ago. Like,
it's still very, like, again, people, it's easy, and even for me, like, again, I as I sit down and I decided to write this book, and I sit down and wrote it, like, you kind of relive all this stuff, and mm-hmm. it kind of reignites some of this stuff. You go, God, things really aren't that different, right?
Yeah.
As you kind of mentioned with those posts, it just, you know, it kind of makes you realize, like, okay. There's still a lot to do. There's a lot to do.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's easy for even me in my Phoenician bubble here now. Just think that everything's fine, right? Because I live in Phoenix. I mean, my neighbors, they don't talk to us. We don't know each other. Like, nobody's mm-hmm. in your business. Nobody really cares who you are, what you do, you know?
Right.
Until then you encounter that. You still encounter that again with frequency. It's still out there. Within your own family, you'll find it in professions, within the workplace. Again, I found myself in very male, straight white male dominated fields, mm-hmm. Construction and large scale high risk stuff, you know, cranes and jackhammers and kind of all that stuff, you know. And again, that's pretty common thing. Like, you know, you hear slurs and things all the time. It's still present in a lot of these fields. So to pretend that it's not present in workplaces, to pretend that it's not present in families, that it's not present in large, small towns, southern towns, southwestern towns, west coast towns, it's still there. It's still there, right? And so I guess where I kind of land with that, even with as far as we've kind of came with this stuff, we still have a lot of work to do. And I think we do a lot of that by sharing our stories. I think sharing our stories, sharing these voices, I think that's a huge portion of how we kind of get there.
Yes. And, you know, I talked about this in the second episode, but in the South, you know, the family is kind of the foundation of your life, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when you're out in the middle of nowhere, like, sometimes your family is the people that you will see the most, like, whether it be your mom, your dad, your cousins, your uncles, like, you're probably living close or around your family. And so that's another just emotional chain that you have whenever you experience the fear, you know.
It's so hard in kind of small town life in general. And as you mentioned, that family dynamic is super interesting because the majority of my life, like I had like 20 cousins.
Yeah.
Like I had like big family. Yeah. I had like a ton of cousins. And so like all of the cousins we were like siblings, right? We were like siblings. We were like best friends. We
Same.
Were like all those things. Mm-hmm. Like that's who, like growing up as like a knee-high kid, you know, mm-hmm. that's who I played with. Like I didn't have other friends. I had cousins. Why do you need to have a play date with anyone else? You have cousins.
Right.
You guys go outside and don't come back till it's dark and play with each other, you know? So when you do get to that point in a small town dynamic, as I kind of mentioned at the beginning, I never felt safe enough to come out until I was 2,000 miles away. Mm-hmm. Because again, coming out there, even living outside of the house, even being established with my own career, even all those things, you know, you run the risk of losing Yes. your entire family. And a lot of times your family, as you mentioned, they're a huge, not only are they your family, but they're a good chunk of your social dynamic too. They're your friends too. You go do stuff with them. You go yeah. do this and you go do that. And you go to cookouts and you go to this and you go to the fall festival and you go, you know, you kind of
right.
do all this stuff with your family. And then all that could be gone. And unfortunately, you don't know how they're going to react until they react.
Exactly.
So you live in this whole kind of build up fear until finally, you know. And unfortunately, like I said, I shared a little bit about kind of the relationship that I have with one of my families, with my mom in particular. Mm-hmm. They don't always react how you hope that they will.
No, they don't. And so that kind of leads me to my next question, which is, does the Southern emphasis on the familial unit play a role in your partnership and or your parenthood?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I find myself as much as, and I'm not like picking on my mom. Again, people come from different eras, different upbringings, you
know, yeah.
different things. And we're working through that. We're trying to see what
right.
that's like. I'm very proud of how far she's come in the past several years. Mm-hmm. But for sure, because I find myself being my mother now more than anything else.
Oh, that's the ultimate fate of every gay man, really.
Right, it's exactly. It's so interesting. I'm like, oh my God, I sound just like my mom. This is horrible. I promised myself I would never do it. But yeah, so it does. I mean, family is everything to us. I think that's the big piece of it. You know, family is absolutely everything to us. I come from a large family. I come from, you know, again, from Appalachia, from the South. To me, same thing. Mm-hmm. It's everything. Absolutely everything. And so that's an interesting dynamic too, to be 2,000 miles away from that now. Mm-hmm. It's freeing in a lot of ways and breaks my heart in a lot of ways at the same time. But so my partner comes from a very large family too. Mm-hmm. So we both have this kind of very big emphasis on family. And absolutely, it's for sure shaped all of those things. I mean, it touches every aspect of it, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it touches every aspect of it. We just always do everything as a family. And, you know, I think that's probably right. the biggest difference I notice is it seems like, because that's the way I was raised, right? There were mm-hmm. no babysitters. There was no like, hey, you're going to go, no. you know, other than maybe you're going to stay with your cousins for a night, right. you know? But so it's like, oh, if I'm going, we're all going. You know, so we just do stuff all together. We go have fun. Yeah, absolutely. It's one big kind of Southern family shindig in Phoenix, I guess.
Do you notice like other families with a different dynamic? Do you feel like you're kind of like one of the only ones that you know of that is kind of like that in Phoenix?
Yeah, it for sure. Like I found other folks, like, you know, you kind of find other people that are like-minded. You just kind of right. attract each other, you know? So I made some really close friends through work, and her family, she's a little bit older. She has some grandkids, and she just reminds me so much of like people from back home in a good way, in like a great
yeah.
way. They're a little more Midwestern. They're Ohio. So we don't count them as Southern.
They're close enough. No.
They're close enough.
Okay.
They're close enough. they're close enough. But it still feels kind of the same because they kind of had the same family dynamic. Uh-huh. So we spent a lot of time hanging out with them. But other than those folks, like everyone else is just like, yeah, just kick the kids off and go do something.
Right. Like,
you know? Don't get me wrong. I mean, we go out and do stuff. I mean, I'm not saying that we don't, but
right.
It is. It's different. We really approach things with kind of the family first mentality that I was raised with, you know, that we were both mm-hmm. kind of raised with. The family always comes first, and then anything we want's kind of second, which is probably a good thing. Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah. Cause you're also the first partnered And when I say partnered, I say partnered in the place of married, because once again, I know you're not married, but you're getting there basically. Yeah. And you're the first one that, and the first person I've interviewed that actually has a child also. So,
So it is interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's because for me, I mean, that's not something that I come across. Well, I will say that in Phoenix in particular, it seems pretty common, because again, just the community is a lot larger. You know, that's not something that I heard, you know, I'd ever heard of, you know, kind of back in the South. Right.
Right.
There's places that I kind of laugh when I say this, because we were driving somewhere. We were back home visiting, and we fly into Charlotte, North Carolina. And I love Charlotte. Like, we kind of chat. We're always like, we're going to move to Charlotte. I think we're going to move to North Carolina. I think we're going to move, because we kind of want to get back into some of that, get a little closer to family, you know, kind of get back into that kind of a little bit, you know. But I bring that up because there's literally like I've literally passed billboards in these states, like talking about how like it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Gay people shouldn't have kids, period. And that's literally like a billboard, like on the side of the road. And I'm like, I took a picture somewhere on my phone, but it was somewhere in North Carolina. And I'm going, so yeah, it's pretty common kind of here in kind of Southwest West Coast area.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it is in more metro areas. It's probably the same in more metro areas, just because, you know, there's a lot more of us. There's a lot more families.
Right.
That you just, I was never exposed to that, you know? And I think that's kind of, not to get off on a side rant here a little bit.
Right.
I already have soapbox a little bit. But, you know, I think that's some of the problem with what rural Appalachia has, is that they never see us in that light.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They've never seen, you know, they've never seen that family unit portrayed that way.
Right.
You know, and they only see the way that we're portrayed maybe in the media or wherever else.
I don't know
what image what draws to their mind. I have no clue. But they've never seen that, for whatever they think we're demons from hell for some
I was going to say, they get to the point in Modern Family where, you know, we meet the gay couple that have kids and they just immediately turn it off, I'm sure. So, right.
This isn't Pat Roberts.
Exactly. This ain't the 700 Club. So your mission statement is to make the world a better place. Okay.
Yeah.
So how would you say that you are doing that?
Yeah. And so I've got to start by saying that, you know, my first mission statement when I first started going down this path, because things have evolved so much from where I first started, when I first started podcasting and first started doing this stuff, It really started as making the world a better place to work. And it still is that to an extent. But I found myself, the more that I branched off, I'm like, it's not really about just making the world a better place to work. Because if I make the world a better place to work, I'm still just trying to make the world a better place, period.
Right.
So I found myself going down that path of I just want to make the world a better place, period. As much as I can, as much impact as I can personally make on that, I'm going to. So for me, a lot of that has started and continues to be around making the world a better place to work. So around making work not suck, you know, around, you know,
yeah,
improving lives at work and improving cultures at work. You know, it's funny because I'm a safety person that ends up going and talking to organizations about how they should treat people. Like, how wacky is that, right?
Right.
I literally go and talk to people about, no, like, you need to be nice to people, and you need to let them express themselves at work, and you need to do this, and you need to make it a place where maybe they don't want to leave every 5 minutes.
You know? Exactly.
So if I can help to create work environments that people come to work happy, that's huge for me. That's a huge success for me. A lot of what I do is I work with other safety professionals to try to help them create those environments too, or try to help them coach them through their careers I was ready to walk away. Like, I was ready to go do anything but this.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, I don't care. I'll live under a bridge. Like, I don't want to do this ever again, you know? Helping people on kind of a one-on-one basis. And then in kind of the grander scheme of things, as I started to, really grow, and I started to understand that our profession had a lot of issues with inclusion, especially of our community.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, okay, something's got to change, right? And that's always been kind of my thing. Like, I'm like a bloodhound to find where stuff sucks. Like, I just want to fix it. Like, I can't stand it when things are horrible, right? If it sucks, like, somebody needs to fix it. And so by trying to work on some of those things, I think that's how I can ultimately help, or I've been helping. And this is the one piece that that has been my proudest is writing and sharing. And I encourage everyone out there, I'll tell people, everyone has a book in them. Everyone has at least one. So if you haven't written something, you should. Anybody out there that wants to, you should. But it's sharing our stories. I think that's such an impactful thing. Storytelling is something that's so important to every community, especially mm-hmm. ours, right? To share those short stories, to share our experiences, to let people know what folks really go through, because it's so easy for folks outside of the community to just look at it and go, oh, yeah, he's complaining again.
Right.
We kind of get this very dismissive attitude. But if enough of us continue to share their stories, or what I've gotten in the past, and I'm sure you've heard this too, is, well, that's just your experience. Most people don't go through that.
I had a guy point blank tell me, and he considers himself an ally, which is fine, but he point blank told me, he's like, I just really don't think people care that much like you think. And it's like,
read some Facebook comments.
Right.
You'd be surprised how much people care.
Exactly. So,
and it tells me that people care when folks are willing to take time, precious time, out of their day to sit down and formulate a response to an ad or a boosted post for someone that they have no clue who you are.
Exactly.
To respond to you, to talk shit to you about who you are.
And it's still part of an American political party's platform, deciding what rights need to be taken away from us. So, like,
exactly,
you know, yeah, so
exactly.
I mean, yeah. Some Enough people said. Care. Yeah. People care. So, yeah.
People care. People care a ton. Yeah, and so to that point exactly is that I think that, you know, continuing to tell stories, and I encourage folks if you're comfortable. Because it is an act of extreme vulnerability to share your story. Mm-hmm. It really is. But those are courageous acts. And for folks to go out and continue to share your stories, whether you share them with your inner circle of friends and family, whether you put it down in a blog post, whether you write it down in a book, whether you do whatever, right? Sharing that story is vital. It's vital into continuing to make things better for everyone, right? I think that's really where so much of it comes from is, you can't really fix problems unless you really have this big glaring spotlight on the problems. Yes. And that's how you put that glaring spotlight on there, is by sharing stories. Because if we all, for most of us, you know, other than just kind of conversations and kind of my soapbox rants, you know, and doing stuff like that here or there.
Yeah.
A couple, you know, a podcast episode here or there that I've done. I hadn't really shared my story until I pretty much just wrote the book.
Yeah.
You know, so I think most of us find ourselves in a position of just being silent, right? And silence isn't a great thing if we want to fix stuff. And it takes all of our stories kind of linking together and kind of building this grander thing to really make things better.
Excellent. So in that vein, and I'm sure you've done a lot of thinking about this next question, especially writing your book, but if you could tell your childhood self any words of wisdom, what would they be?
So it's something that for me, I would really keep it simple and it would just be, fuck everybody else. I mean, that's honestly where I'd kind of keep it, because that's ultimately where I kind of evolved to. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in the way of that, if people can't appreciate you and love you and accept you for who you are, don't waste your time. And I don't mean that in the place of saying, don't talk to those people, don't try to help them, because you can. But there's a point, there's a time and place where maybe you just need to say, look, my time is too precious to waste it. Right.
So
I kind of found myself in this position of that. Of kind of fuck everybody else in that sense. Just be yourself. If you just focus on being yourself, that's ultimately the path to being happy, is just being you, unapologetically you.
Yes.
Whatever makes you happy, whatever, anything that gets in the way of pure happiness in your life is not worth your time. And because it's just too short, right? You get one go around on this thing, and it's too short to be hiding. It's too short to be sad. It's too short to be depressed. It's too short to deal with all the things that lead you into those things. So yeah, that would be the real one piece of advice, is just kind of fuck everybody else and just focus on being happy. That's it. That's really it. Everybody else can get over themselves.
Yes.
You shouldn't be forced to get over yourself.
Exactly. And I guess that kind of, that point that you came to is kind of how you, how would I say, I guess you kind of mirror that where you're trying to teach other people how to not give a fuck while also being safe.
Right. Guess, yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so it is that. And so, and I do preface that, like, you know, or going back to that is that for sure, like, and I made a point to say this in the book, hindsight's horrible, right? Because yeah, you can always look back now that I know the outcome. And now that I know the way that people feel or certain people feel, and I know how things panned out, it's really easy for me to kind of sit in like my recliner and look back and go, well, I could have done this and I should have done that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course everything was fine. I should have just told that, you know, told that person to fuck you and fuck off, you know, everything's fine.
Right.
But at the time you don't know that, right? At the time you don't know that. So, again, you just focus on being you. If you just focus on being you, that doesn't necessarily mean coming out. Mm-hmm. You know, I think coming out happens when it's supposed to happen. I really believe that we find ourselves coming out when we're supposed to. But if you're not in a safe position to come out, I'm not going to tell you to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, again, looking back at kind of my upbringing, for sure, like if I would have come out, it would have probably been horrible for me. Right. I would have been the kid like chained in a cage in the woods somewhere, getting electrocuted by some wacky backwoods pastor. You know, some weird gay conversion camp, you know? So you have to evaluate your setting. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, but either way, you just focus on being you. And if you're in a position to where you can't, like, I found my way out. That's ultimately what I did, you know? And I think that's what some of us have to do, unfortunately, you know, is kind of find our way to a safe position and then we can come out. But yeah, I still land back on the advice though, at the end of the day, you know, fuck everybody else.
Right.
You know, fuck everybody else. Again, side rant, but because you're going to find those people that are like, you know, we can still be friends. I don't accept that part of your life, who you are, but we can still be. Fuck those people too.
No, fuck them. It's all or nothing, honey. It is exactly. All or nothing.
Well, the problem is this. Is that you hope, and we're raised on this myth that that folks will love you unconditionally. And the unfortunate truth is that love is very conditional for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, if you're coming out to some extremely religious people, some of those conditions involve you being straight.
Yeah.
Now I will say that, but then I'll kind of go to the other side and say that when you do come out, that sometimes they'll way surprise you too.
Mm-hmm.
The people that you would expect to absolutely just think you're the most vile thing on the planet for who you are will accept you with open arms. And some of the folks that you would think should accept you will be like, get away from me. You know, I still have friends that surprise me. On both sides of that, just personal friends, completely non-religious friends that on both sides of that fence that
really
just surprised me. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
God.
I've got several friends that were just like, okay, bye. You know, really? Okay.
I guess. God.
Fine, I guess.
I mean, that made it a lot easier, yeah. I guess, you know, moving on. So.
Yeah. Well, again, you don't know until you know. And then you just kind of deal with it, I guess, once you do.
So, Sam, thank you so much for coming out in the woods today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You are more than welcome anytime you want to come back. We are always glad to have you. Now, for my listeners, do you have any shout outs and where can people find you and your work?
So it's odd to say, but I'm big on not Instagram. I wish I was big on Instagram. I'm not. I'm big on LinkedIn of all places. That's silly me for being a professional.
What a pro! Yeah,
I have a lot of followers on LinkedIn. It's kind of strange. So you can find me anywhere that you find anybody on social media. You can pretty much find me if you search The Hop Nerd. That's an easy way to find me on Instagram. On LinkedIn, you can find The Hop Nerd. You can just find me under my name. You just look for Sam Goodman. I have several websites. If you're interested in the stuff that we've got going on with publishing or anything like that. We publish people. So if anybody out there likes writing books or anything and they're looking for a publisher, that's kind of what we do. So you can head over to palehorsemedia.co.co. And if you want to find out anything that I've got going on, you can just go to sugoodman.com and it links to pretty much everything else. Mm-hmm. So if you just go to sugoodman.com, you can find my books. You can find, all the other podcasts that I do, all the other stuff that I'm involved in. And then obviously the books and stuff are on Amazon and I'm just pretty much everywhere. If you just go look.
He is everywhere. I've looked. So Sam, you have a great day, and please, I know you're into the paranormal, so please watch out for skinwalkers. Okay. They are out there in Arizona.
They are. We have an episode coming up soon.
Oh my God, I can't wait. Oh my God.
Yeah, so a very close friend of mine was born and raised on the reservation. A very good Navajo friend of mine is going to have some expertise in skinwalkers and is going to come on and he's promised to, at least. So let's see what happens. He's going to come on and chat with us.
Oh my God. That is going to be
fun.
Incredible. Yes.
The unfortunate part for you though is now that my gears are spinning, I'm going, well, I think we need to have like a Southern edition on really fucking scary stories. And I think you would be great to come on and tell stories.
Please. I would love to. Just wait. Okay. Halloween time. We're gonna get into some really spooky stuff. Let's here out in the woods. Okay.
Let's do it.
Have a great day and happy Labor Day.
You too.
Thank y'all so much for tuning in to another episode. If you enjoyed it, go ahead and give us a rate, a review, a subscribe, and spread the word so more people can climb in my closet. And click that listener support button to put your money in my digital G-string. Follow us on Instagram at ONTW_podcast, or follow us on Facebook. And last but not least, sign up for LGBT mail, y'all. Look, I say it all the time. The subscriber count is growing, but please, come on, do it. You'll get an email every Friday to ring in each new episode with fun little goodies, including On This Day in Gay History. To sign up, simply follow the link in my bio on Instagram or click the sign up button at the top of my Facebook page. And once again, as always, thanks for coming out in the woods and into my closet. Thank you.